Welcome to another episode of Daughters of Mormonism. I'm your host, Sybil. Today, I'll be interviewing Jenna about her relationship with the Divine Feminine and a project she has started in hope of further light and knowledge about our Heavenly Mother. Jenna, it's so good to have you here on Daughters of Mormonism. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So before we get to your project, I'd like to hear about your journey to know the Divine Feminine. Tell us about your relationship and background with the Church. How did you first come to learn about Mother in Heaven?
Well, I was born in the Church, and in fact, I was actually adopted in the Church as well. And so I've grown up with it, and I don't remember where it came across. When I was a young kid, I heard about this idea of Mother in Heaven, and I really glommed onto it. But as has been mentioned several times, there's not really a lot of information. So I exhausted my resources fairly early on, or at least I thought I had. And so I kind of shelved it for a while. I knew she was there, but there wasn't a lot that I felt like I could do with it. So I continued growing up in the Church, baptized at 8. I think I was president of Beehives, Maya Maids, and Laurels, not so much because I'm so awesome, but more that I was possibly the most regular attendee in my ward at my age. You know, I'm still active in the Church. I've grown up knowing that this was there.
Did it make a difference for you being adopted? Is that part of the reason that you wanted to have your mother?
No, I wouldn't say so. It's interesting. I've always known I was adopted. It wasn't like it was sprung on me when I was older. I've always known, but I am extremely close with my mother. I don't see her as my adoptive mother or second mother or anything like that. She is my mother. You know, we were sealed together as a family when I was 1 year old. You know, I don't feel like there's ever been anything particularly lacking in that relationship at all. I have been curious about my birth mother, and actually I'm in the process. I've got the paperwork that I need to get notarized and everything, but I am in the process of seeking out my birth mother. So I am going through that, but no, I don't feel that there was a lack in that relationship that would necessarily drive my desire to connect with a feminine being. I grew up developing my relationship with Heavenly Father and with Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit and everything. And for years, that really felt like it was enough for me. It wasn't until fairly recently that I really kind of went, you know, I know this is there, but there's really not a lot of information. And, oh, there's these other people that are agreeing with me. Why don't we know more? But no, my paternal relationship is good. My maternal relationship was good. You know, I grew up in a fairly functional and balanced home. So I've been happy, and it's not through feeling a particular lack in my earthly relationships.
So you mentioned how when you first sort of encountered the idea of Mother in Heaven as a child, that you recognized that this was there, but that there wasn't too much there. And in our email correspondence, you mentioned that you feasted on the crumbs that did exist. How did you feast on these crumbs? What did you do?
Well, of course, there is the hymn, Oh My Father, and that has been one of my very favorite hymns for a very long time. So I really kind of glommed onto that. I love that word, glom. I attached myself to that as kind of the one solid example of, yes, this is here. Alongside of that, I believe it was my parents who were the first ones who told me, yes, we have a mother in heaven, and she's there. And so I had that, and, you know, I'd look through, like, the Bible dictionary. Yeah, there's nothing. Unfortunately.
Totally.
And Mormon doctrine, I think there is a little blurb in there about Mother in Heaven. And just a few various things. When I would, you know, just run across it, like in Sunday school or young women's, and people would mention, you know, Heavenly Father and, oh yes, Heavenly Mother as well. Just kind of throw her in there, and I would be like, tell me more. I know you can't because there's no information, so drat. But it was always just, it was kind of there in the back of my head, and I was I think I've been blessed to be one of the women who can look at this principle and know that it's there and kind of apply everything else that I know from growing up in the gospel and kind of tacking her in there. So it was just always kind of in the back of my mind.
So it was kind of like as you were growing up, she was a background presence, but in your foreground, you were developing all of the correlated relationships, you know, that you can have your relationships with God the Father and Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit, like you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, she was just kind of there. I didn't know why we didn't talk to her. I was, I think, 9 or so when President Hinckley made the speech, Daughters of God. And so I was really kind of young and oblivious to the whole, you know, do not pray. This is something we're kind of smacking down on. And so I was too young to really think, oh, well, isn't that something that maybe I should challenge? You know, is that really something that, you know, is right? Do I really believe that? Putting it to the test as we have been challenged to do. So I just kind of accepted it and grew up that way for give or take 20 years until this point where I'm like, I wonder.
Okay, so you grew up in your strong family.
Mm-hmm. I was a bishop's kid. My mom was in the Relief Society's presidency. Like I said, I was seminary president too. Not that I'm so great, but again, just, I'm just there. I was there and I was willing to do the work. And that's kind of how my whole family is. We're here. We're willing to work our butts off. Yay.
So you have a strong loyalty, it sounds like.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so you grew up this loyal young woman and passed through your teen years. And where did things go from there?
After high school, I stayed in my family ward for a little while. I ended up becoming a stake missionary back when we had stake missionaries, and then became a ward missionary when they made that transition. And I remained in my home ward for about a year and a half or so before going to the singles ward. And went there. Didn't really date a lot. Still don't date a lot. Yay. Yay, single. And I was going to college at the time, and wasn't really finding anything that interested me, and I knew that I had to find something. So I actually went to herb school first and ended up dropping out of that. It was not where I was supposed to be. And through dropping out of that was when I found massage school, which was where I was supposed to be. I suppose I should mention alongside of that, that was about when I was 21, and I had grown up as a child wanting to go on a mission. And for a few years, kind of early teens, I decided, oh, I don't really want to go on a mission. And then in my late teens at EFY, I was in one lecture about missionary work, and the speaker told us that President Hinckley had challenged the youth of the church to basically grow up in such a way that we could double the number of missionaries. And we were hovering around 50, 60,000 at that point. Ironically, the same point that we're still going around now. I guess we failed. We failed on a massive scale. But anyway, so he challenged us to be among the ones who would double that. And at that point, I was like, okay, yes, I am going to help. I am going to jump in, and this is what I'm going to do. And at about 20, I had my paperwork and everything. I think I got it right at the beginning of September. I'm a January baby. So I got it right at the beginning of September. You know, I was filling it out, and I'm not a person that likes to be pushed. And it seemed like everybody in the world was asking me, so how's your paperwork going? Where are you going? Where do you want to go? Have you turned in your papers yet? You know, where are you in it? Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, stop asking me. I got really stressed out about it. And I went and I consulted my patriarchal blessing and realized that the line in there specifically about me serving a mission was really more of a, if you want to, you can do this. I'm like, okay, I don't want to anymore. Yay, no more pressure. So I decided not to go on a mission. I was still a ward missionary at that point. But full-time mission, I decided, was not the course for me at that point. And so that's when I applied to herb school. Like I said, didn't go through with that and went on to massage school at the age of 21. And while I was in massage school, I was going to institute down in Arizona, and I met a guy there and we started dating, and I stayed in Arizona to see where that relationship went. And I ended up getting engaged to him, and we moved back up to California, and we were getting ready for the wedding, and I broke it off. And I'm grateful for that almost every day since then. So,
okay, I have a feeling there's a whole lot more to this story than you're telling us.
There is. It became fairly obvious, actually very obvious, fairly early on in the relationship that he had a pornography addiction. And I stayed with him. I thought that I could help him. And if I just stuck by him and stuck it out, it would be okay. I, being young and naive and idealistic, I stood by my man. And I put up with a whole truckload of problems that came with it. And he turned out to be emotionally and mentally and spiritually abusive. And I said, no, thank you. After a while, it took me moving back up here to California and actually spending time on the temple grounds. I wasn't endowed at that point. And a conversation with my mother to realize that this was not going to work at all. And that I had to get rid of him. And I had to do it soon. And I did. So,
sounds like it was a fairly intense piece of life that you lived through there.
It really was. It was kind of a mixed bag. It was, it was probably the most traumatic experience of my life that I can remember, that whole 7-month period. But it was good in a way, because that was when I really learned how I pray, how I communicate with the divine, how I communicate with Father. And I mean, I live 10 minutes down the road from the Mesa, Arizona temple, and I would drive over there frequently and just walk around the grounds and pray as I spent time there. And I developed a lot spiritually, being on sacred ground and communing with the divine. So in that way, I'm very grateful I had that experience.
So in your email, you mentioned something that I have a feeling has to do with this part of your life about calling on the name of Christ and the priesthood. And I'm just dying to know what this means.
Yes, it was this part of my life. It was after we had moved up here to California. And my parents raised me, and this may be something that I just, again, sort of glommed onto early on in life, where it had only been mentioned a couple of times. But I grew up with this knowledge and this feeling that as a woman, even though I haven't been ordained to the priesthood, if I lived a worthy life, I could, in a time when no other priesthood holder was around, I could call on the priesthood of a man who had lordship over me, primarily my father or my bishop or whoever was applicable. And there was a situation with my ex where we were having a fight, and I felt that he was under the influence of the adversary at that moment. And I raised my arm to the square and invoked the priesthood of my father. And in the name of Jesus Christ, I told Satan, get thee hence. And the situation calmed down. I don't know if that means that it literally happened. I feel like it did. I felt like it was effective. And it was really empowering to me to feel like I had that as a resource to myself.
Wow. So this is a fascinating experience. How did this come into your mind that that was what you were going to do?
It's one of those things that kind of float around in the back of my head. I would think about it every once in a while. And for that particular situation, he and I had already had a history of discussing when the adversary was present. He had seemed to have a minor obsession with it, I think, or a major one. I don't know. It seemed fairly minor to me, but it was already kind of in the context of our relationship already. In fact, there were a few experiences that I had with him where dark feelings and the sensation of a dark presence was there. Stupid me, I still stuck around. You know, so it was really already in the context of our relationship. So it didn't feel like that much of a leap, because at that point I was the only person present who I felt was accepting of divine help, basically. I was the only person present who could stop what was going on. And yeah. I guess I've always had sort of a mystic take on my relationship with the divine, where I rely a lot on my internal relationship and connection with God. And so crazy things like a woman invoking the priesthood through her father were just things that I was ready to do. If I needed to do it, I was ready to do it. And I had made that decision early on in life that if there was a situation, I was going to live in such a way that I would be ready to do it.
Fascinating. So I'm getting like this very interesting, complex picture of you that's almost like a paradox of this woman who will raise her arm to the square and cast Satan out, and at the same time is sticking in a relationship that's, you know, so dangerous in a way. Yep. And so what was it that made you feel like you were talking about sticking by your man and so forth? And what was the thing that kept you in?
I am an overly compassionate person. I will admit that. And I seem to attract people that have problems. And he was no exception. And I sincerely wanted to help him. At first it was, here I am. And part of it was the whole paradigm of marrying young in the church. I was 22 by that point, and I wanted to get married, darn it. I had this whole plan where I would get married in my early to mid 20s. I would, you know, have kids couple years later, and I would have a whole slew of them. So he seemed to fit into that really nicely, especially since I had just graduated from school. Yay, I had my whole life together, right? No. It turned from a love relationship to what I recognize now it was really a codependency. I wanted to help him. And I felt like I was the only person in his life who could help him. He was a recent convert to the church. He had moved from the East Coast to Arizona. And while he had a few other friends, like, he didn't have family, he didn't have the people he had grown up with. So I felt like it was kind of my place to step in and help him. But yeah, basically there was this really strong part of me that is the woman willing to raise my arm to the square. But there was also this huge naivete. Like I said earlier, I didn't date a lot in my early 20s. Well, that was a continuation of I didn't date a lot as a teenager either. And so I didn't have a lot of experience with men. I really didn't know what I was doing. I hadn't yet learned what it was that I should and shouldn't be looking for. You know, I'd grown up being told, you know, you should look for a man who treats you well. Well, he treated me well when he wasn't being an abusive jerk. That's the way they keep you around, right? So it was kind of a paradox. And, you know, that was another part that I was grateful for, because it really did open my eyes to not everybody's nice. People do have problems, and sometimes there's just nothing you can do about it.
It sounds like also that at this point in your life, you were realizing, like you were saying, you know, this kind of naive outlook on the world, that you were seeing him as part of this narrative that you were ready to live, to get married and have your slew of children, right? And you had your degree or your massage degree and everything. You had your life together. Mm-hmm. As you were spelling that out, it's like, yeah, you were ready to be this good Mormon woman and do what you were supposed to do. And it sounds like this experience kind of fractured that and made you look at who you were and what you were differently.
Yeah, a little bit. I still continued on in really kind of wanting to live that script for a long time. And, you know, so it didn't, this experience didn't completely destroy it. I was able to kind of compartmentalize it and kind of go, okay, well, that apparently was the wrong man to do it. Next! Next in line. Oh, there's not a line. Crap. Well, all right then. But it didn't so much fracture it, I think, as expose the potential weaknesses in it.
Yeah.
Because I think that there is this, this is the weaknesses that I think there is in the way that we raise young women in the church, is that as we're going through and teaching them about this script, that we're not telling them well enough that, oh, by the way, not every guy going to be the right one. These may be boys that you, you know, see in your institute classes or see at church. They may even be passing the sacrament to their own detriment. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are doing what they should. And you need to be on the lookout for these signs of an emotionally unhealthy relationship. I do wish that we emphasize what a healthy relationship looks like a little bit more, so that women and men can recognize what it is, either see it in their own relationships or see it in themselves, and avoid it, because it doesn't help anybody when we're not making that an issue, because we are human. You know, we try to pretend that we're not, and that we're this perfect people, but we're not. Things happen in our church as much as they happen anywhere else. The problem is we don't talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think, like what you were saying, a lot of times young women are sort of raised to think, well, he has the priesthood, or he's a returned missionary, or, you know, and so therefore, check, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that was exactly it. I remember being in young women's, and we would make lists of the kind of man we wanted to marry. And of course, on almost everybody's list was, you know, return missionary, priesthood holder, temple worthy or temple recommend, virgin, unmarried, etc., etc. And this is kind of the way that we grow up, and the things that, you know, we're told that we want, someone who's remained virtuous and things like that. And while those are all good things, I don't think it paints a complete picture of what these young women may experience when they get out in the world. Not everybody has remained virtuous. They may have gone through the repentance process, and they may be virtuous now, but they may not have always been. That doesn't mean that they should, that men like that should be discounted completely. A man may hold a temple recommend, but that doesn't mean that he was completely truthful all the time, and that doesn't automatically mean that he is a worthy priesthood holder. He may be a priesthood holder. That doesn't mean he knows how to treat you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And even if, let's say, we have a virtuous returned missionary who worthily holds a temple recommend and worthily holds the priesthood, he might still be a really rotten partner.
Exactly.
Like when you were saying your list, I was like, well, but nowhere on that list are we having good communication skills, treats me with respect, has good eye contact with me when I am expressing my ideas, believes in my dreams as well.
Yeah.
The things that actually create the foundation for an excellent relationship are missing on that list, and only these outward checklist type things are there. And I think you're right. It sets us up for an almost scary naivety that, I don't know, it's like the trap is just waiting to be sprung almost.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's a difficult thing because, you know, and I can understand the position that that puts our leaders in, because you don't want to say, you don't want to villainize the other side, basically. You know, we don't like to expose our foibles and our follies. We really don't. And we really do want to, I give props for wanting to emphasize the positive and say, these are the positive things that you should look for, and these are the good things that you should look for. I give props for that because I'm an optimistic person. I like to look on the good, on the bright side of things, and I like to keep it positive. However, the dark side does need to be acknowledged, that somebody can go through and have this checklist, but you need to look deeper. And you need to examine your relationship. And I'm not trying to imply that 75% or even 50% of the, you know, temple recommend holding return missionaries with good jobs out there are bad partners. But it's something that it would be useful for the young women to be told, even if they have these qualities, there's other things that you need to look at.
Yeah, and not only to look at, but also to develop in the relationship. I've seen this mentality before of, well, you know, he fits the checklist and I fit the checklist, so therefore if we get married in the temple, we have it made. And it's like, well, that doesn't make a relationship.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, you know, some people, I honestly believe that some people can do that. That can work for some people. But just like the people that meet each other and get engaged 3 weeks later and are married within 3 months, and they go on to have their happy relationship, you know, these are the urban legends and sometimes even the people we know that we hear about. And the reason we hear about them is because that story is extraordinary. But we all want that extraordinary story, whether it's appropriate for us or not. And for most of us, that sort of a story and that sort of a checklist, okay, we're good, let's go to the temple relationship, for most people, it's not appropriate. Just to kind of throw this in there, just while we're on the topic, one of my sister's friends had been in a relationship, and this really kind of informed my process later on when I realized what was going on with my relationship. She had married this man, he was an RM, and she felt like she had gotten this yes from the spirit, that yes, this man would be a good person to marry. And so she went and married him, and the relationship again turned abusive. I think possibly physically abusive, if I'm remembering correctly. I may not be. But it was a negative relationship for her to be in, and she eventually divorced him. And as she was going through her process, she's like, how can this happen? How can this have happened? Because I got a yes answer. I got a confirmation from the spirit. And isn't that what we're always told to look for? And she got another impression, again, while she was in the temple, she got a deeper impression that had he, her ex-husband, had he remained faithful to his covenants, or perhaps it was that he had cheated on her, I don't remember, this was years ago, had he stayed true to his relationships, he would have been the right man. And so at that time, while he was staying true, he was. But at some point that changed. And at that point he became a no. But I don't know. That's just something that when I was going through it, because I felt like early on in my relationship, I had had a yes, that it would be a good thing for me to be in this relationship with him. And ultimately it was, because like I said, I learned a lot. It, all those things were to my experience, to paraphrase Doctrine and Covenants. And that was a section that I drew from a lot. But in going through that process, I wasn't checking in with, okay, this is going on. Is this still what I should be doing? This doesn't feel right. And I think that that reevaluation is something that's not emphasized. It's kind of, well, you get your answer and you go forward. And there is merit to that. But I think it would be useful for people to hear, well, every once in a while, you may need to reevaluate that and ask again if something's going on. So that's my two cents on that subject.
Okay, so you made it through this fairly traumatic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of initiated you into a more aware adulthood. So where did you go from there?
Well, from there, I moved on to becoming a quote-unquote career woman. Once I had broken up with him, I moved into using my massage diploma. I went on to become a private practice massage therapist. And I returned to my singles ward after about 6 months. I gave myself a little bit of a rest period. And things kind of just floated along for a few years. There's a few years there that were nothing in particular of note happened. I continued working. I continued going to church. Continued not dating a lot. And I ended up going and receiving my endowment in late 2008 when I was 25. Again, not in preparation for marriage or for a mission. I had wanted my endowment. I had been wanting it for years. And then right about the time that I was first thinking about going through the temple when I was 19 was when the, unless you have a marriage or a mission to go on, we're advising you not to get your endowment until you're 25. I'm like, okay, then I guess I won't. In 2009, I started volunteering at the Oakland Temple and working there. And after a few months, I became an ordinance worker. And so I spent almost exactly 2 full years working in the temple. And that was a wonderful experience for me. And I grew a lot, especially once I became an ordinance worker and began participating in the ordinances themselves, in the initiatory, in the endowment, and exercising the authority that I had been given there.
When you became an ordinance worker and participated in giving these different ordinances to other women, did this feel like it connected to that part of you that was willing to raise your arm to the square and cast Satan out?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember really feeling like, you know, here I was, you know, we're told that we're hostesses in the house of the Lord when we're volunteers and ordinance workers. And at that point, when I became an ordinance worker, I also felt like I was a priestess in the house of the Lord. I had an authority to exercise that was equal with the men. And I've never actually been one who really, really, really wanted the priesthood. Like, I, for most of my life, I was content being like, okay, I'm a woman, whatever. The guys have the priesthood. And I actually, in my early 20s, started taking on the opinion that really the priesthood is for the men's benefit, makes them more like us. That properly exercised, the priesthood teaches a man to be more nurturing, more caring, more self-sacrificing, much more like these qualities that we think of being feminine. And so I wasn't terribly bothered by that, but getting the opportunity to perform ordinances in a way that I knew was going to be eternally binding and doing that as a woman was fulfilling. I wouldn't necessarily say empowering because I didn't feel like I was unempowered, but I would say it was really fulfilling and satisfying.
Did this enhance your relationship with your mother in heaven?
I feel like it did. I felt like in doing that, I really felt like I really had a place in the church. Not that I ever felt particularly like I didn't have a place. I've never felt particularly disenfranchised. I don't know why I was blessed with that, but I was. But I know that that's not everybody's experience, but it was mine. But being able to feel like the spiritual work that I was doing was really important. And that knowing that, especially the blessings of the initiatory and everything that's encompassed in that ceremony and the words there really opened up this view for me that this is what I'm going to be when the eternities come, when this mortal probation is over and we move on to our next estate. That I'm going to be a queen, I'm going to be a priestess, and I'm going to be a goddess. And that really started to re-emphasize this idea of the divine feminine in my life, because I was able to work with this idea that, yes, it's going to happen. This is what I'm meant for. And at this time, outside of the temple, I was studying a lot of issues regarding birth and motherhood, as well as a massage therapist. I'm a doula.
Will you just say briefly what a
doula is?
So
people know. That word is becoming more common, but people still don't know what it is. A doula is a woman who's there to mother the mother through labor and delivery. She's there to be a support, to be a constant companion, someone who's there who knows about birth, who's experienced with it in one way or another. In my case, having attended various births and having studied about it, and who's there to help the mother communicate with her care providers, be that an OB, an L&D nurse, a midwife, whoever, and to provide comfort measures through touch or sound or whatever, And basically, to fulfill this role that we no longer have in our mainstream culture of women supporting women as they become mothers. So I had attended my sister's first birth, and that gave me the birth bug. And so I was going through this process to be a doula and to study it. And that really, really strengthened. I already had a testimony of motherhood and how important it is, and that it's a divine calling, and that mother in heaven is a powerful and worthy person. But this work with studying about birth really struck that home in a way that wasn't just kind of esoteric spiritual. It's like, no, this is the cycle of life. And this is part of our divinity of being mothers, of being women, and that we can do this in a way that's strong and that we don't have to be afraid. So that really kind of, it kind of brought the divine down to the physical for me, just helping women to initiate that part of them.
It sounds like parts of your life were starting to really come together, that your work as a massage therapist and a doula was coming together with your spirituality mm-hmm. and your strong craving toward your own divine potential and so forth. It sounds like you were coming together as a whole being in a really beautiful way. And you've got this strong current of empowerment that's kind of flowed underneath all of your life. And did it start to come to the surface at this point as you were coming together? Were there different ways that you started to awaken?
There were. I'd always considered myself very traditional. I was a good Molly Mormon type of girl. And as I went through this experience with my ex, and as I was being a career woman, quote unquote, you know, having my own business and working and concentrating on this career of helping people and working with other women so strongly at such an important point in their lives, I really started to feel like the role that I had been taught that I needed to fulfill was not quite everything that I wanted to be. In my early and mid-20s, I kind of had this whisper in the back of my head, "You're a feminist." Oh, crap. No, no. Not the F word. No, I'm not a feminist. Feminists are evil. But it was always just kind of back there. But I didn't identify with it, even though so much of my work was about empowering women in being women. Which, in my thought, really is the essence of feminism, empowering women to be women. So I'm going through this process, and about a little over a year ago, a year and a half ago, actually about the time that I was working in the temple, I was feeling more like that I was a feminist. I was starting to feel like, you know, women are powerful. Women are awesome. This work, not only spiritually in the church, but this work in the world could not be done without women. If it was just men, things would fall apart. And things have fallen apart, but that's for later. And I started inwardly identifying as a feminist, but I couldn't bring myself yet to express it. And I don't remember who sent me this article, but there's this great article online titled, "Yes, You Are." I think it's on tomatonation.com. And it really brought the essence of feminism down to a level that I felt like, as a traditional woman, it was accessible. You know, the article starts out with the definition of feminism, and I'll read it here. "The theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes, or organized activity on behalf of women's rights and interests." And that was basically what I was doing, particularly as a doula. That was what I did. I was advocating for women's strengths and women's rights in the setting of birth, which, if you've studied birth in the United States at all, you can see how very easy it is for women to be disempowered and disenfranchised in that setting, which is completely cockeyed, but that's a rant for another day. This article goes on and basically brings it down to, if you believe in, support, look fondly on, hope for, and or work toward equality of the sexes, you are a feminist. And it repeats that several times throughout the article. And it goes on about, you know, feminism doesn't require you to be this, it doesn't require you to be that, it doesn't require you to be X, Y, or Z, but if you look at it this way, then you are. And that gave me the courage to say, okay, there's not as much baggage on this word as I thought there was. Or the baggage is there, but I don't have to internalize it. And so I basically came out of the feminist closet and said, yes, this is my opinion. I think that women should be treated this way and that there should be equality, and therefore I am. So that was how I made that transition.
Where did things go from there as you pursued your brand new feminism?
From there, I had a few good friends online, and in talking with them, I became more comfortable in it because here were these wonderful, faithful LDS women who also identified as feminists. And here I was working in the temple and performing ordinances and everything. And kind of alongside of this, I've always also been a little bit obsessed with Eve. And, you know, that is a prominent part of the temple ceremony. Several prominent parts. And so that really kind of fired my imagination too. As well as several years ago, I also read Beverly Campbell's Eve and the Choice Made in Eden, which takes a fantastic look, in my opinion, on the way that Eve's choice was a good one and how she's not this villain that history has painted her out to be. And so I was going along, and eventually I started this blog called Like Unto Eve. Actually, it was originally Like Unto Mother Eve. I used it to kind of process where I was spiritually and how I was dealing spiritually with this feminist awakening. At the time, I was also reading Susan Weed's Healing Wise, and the first portion of that book talks about the wise woman tradition, which is always a tradition that through herb school and through various healing arts, I've always felt really connected with. So all these things were kind of coming together. And actually through talking on another forum with some of my friends, I think it was Jenny B, who started this thread about Mother in Heaven on the forum. And that really kind of got me thinking about her more. And that thread led to a discussion group, and in the discussion group we would really start talking more about Mother in Heaven and why she isn't around in the scriptures and how she has been, you know, actually written out, things like that, and where she went. And so it was all of these things, but I'd say of late the biggest contributing factor was my discussions with other Mormon feminists, other daughters of Mormonism. So that's kind of been my journey. That's kind of been my journey of late. And this has been a fairly recent within this year where I had made this evolution from, oh, I'm going to find a nice priesthood holder to a nice returned missionary to marry and have a gad of kids with, to, well, I'm 29 and single and I have a career. And I'm a feminist, and oh, I really want to know about my heavenly mother, about God the Mother, and learn more about her example and who she is.
So this brings us to your fascinating project. Tell us about what made you decide to act. What did you decide to do, and how did you decide to do it?
Through this discussion group, most of the women in the group, it's a fairly small group, but most of the women there, I mean, we all kind of grew up in what people have termed TBM, True Believing Mormon ways and settings and stuff. But here we were, suddenly the lot of us have turned into quote-unquote radicals. Oh no, women on the loose! But, you know, we had made this journey from, you know, very mainstream Mormonism, kind of migrating out and taking the tent stakes with us, frankly, expanding the stakes of Zion in our own way. We had kind of moved off. And, you know, it was kind of one of those things, well, if we are thinking about it this way, you know, and we started recognizing movements in other sects of Christianity toward the divine feminine. Of course, the previous foundational works that have already been put down, like the work of Carolyn Pearson and Margaret Toscano, and, you know, other names, Sue Monk Kidd and her journey in Dance of the Dissident Daughter, and just the work of hundreds of women. And there just seemed to be this upwelling in recent months and years, decades too, but particularly lately, also with the BYU Studies article coming out regarding Mother in Heaven. And it just seemed to be this real synchronistic upwelling of interest in the divine feminine, not only in the Mormon Church, but in other areas of the world, outside areas, secularly in other faiths, everything. And so we were kind of talking about this. We're like, you know, this is happening all over the place. And I've always kind of been one that when synchronicity is happening, jump on it. So I said, you know, it occurred to me, I'm like, you know, there's all this stuff going on. I kind of wonder. And this podcast was part of that too. we were like, hey, there's this podcast. And there's this other lady on Facebook who has a page called Heavenly Mother's Daughter, and just various sources. And we're like, okay, well, this sort of stuff is happening. And I said, you know, I wonder if this is a preparation period for us culturally in order to receive new revelation. Because if you look back historically, I mean, all major revelations have typically had some sort of a preparatory period. You know, the children of Israel, I mean, they wandered in the desert for 40 years before they were prepared to go into the promised land. The United States as a country took about 300 years to form, and it had, you know, it required a massive shift in Western thinking through the Enlightenment for the church to even be possible once the country had been established. I could go on, but there's, you know, just these other things that synchronicity happened. And things built on each other. And it seemed to me, I was like, well, you know, this could be a preparatory period. It seems too coincidental for this not to be somehow significant. And so I'm going along, I'm like, okay, so if it is preparatory, what do we do about that? I mean, you know, even just talking about the church of itself, that's like 14 million people. That's a lot of people that we have to prepare to receive this revelation, if it is indeed coming. You know, if it is indeed one of the great and marvelous things pertaining to the kingdom of God that we say that we believe that God will reveal. Why not Heavenly Mother be one of those? So I was thinking about it, and I'm like, well, why don't I fast and pray for this? I've had so many experiences with fasting where I've received light and knowledge through that sacrifice. And I went, okay, so why don't I do that? Why don't I talk to my friends about doing that? Oh, heck, why don't I just put up a blog post and start throwing it out there for people to find? And so I said, you know, this is something really important to us, or at least to those to whom it is important. It is important. So why don't we do something about it? You know, we have this foundation as a people of being truth seekers. And it seems like we don't do that so much anymore. We seek for that confirmation. You know, is it true? I want my testimony. It seems like once we get our testimony, again, like I was saying earlier, once we get that confirmation, there's not a lot of reevaluation and digging deeper. At least as far as I can tell. I could be completely wrong on that. I don't want to offend anybody with that, but it seems like to me that's the way it goes. That once we have the confirmation and we get in line for our lessons and we have our lessons and we learn things eventually, but we don't really dig a lot of the time. And I know that, I mean, if you look at various conference talks, we're really kind of hounded about that, about deepening our knowledge. And so I said, you know, why don't we put this out there? To those that are interested, you know, by all means, join us. To those that aren't, you don't have to. No one's going to force you to do it. But for people that this is important to, who really want to know Mother in Heaven, want to know more about her, why don't we get together and organize ourselves, not as a particularly as a movement or as an advocacy, but just a search for truth. The way I look at it is not, we're not petitioning for change. We're not advocating for the upheaval of life as we know it. To me, what the Mother Fast is about is saying to God and Goddess, as a people, whether Mormon or not, you know, this is open to anybody who's interested, but saying to them as a people, we want to know about this. This is really, really important to us. And we feel like it hasn't been emphasized. And we, as a people, are ready to hear. We're here. Our hearts are open. Our minds are open. Give us the knowledge, please. And so that's why I've done it the way that I have, just through a blog, just through people sharing the link. And the hope is that through this series of fasting, it's set up to be done every month on the third Sunday, doing it as a group, and hopefully as more people do it, we will be proving to God that we're ready, that we're going to take this seriously, because for whatever reason that it hasn't been revealed, we haven't made it a point, to my knowledge, to ask it. And so we're proving our devotion to our God, and our, in fact, our gods, and saying, we're ready.
This is great. Okay, so, Jenna, spell it out for us. Give us the invitation. Invite us
to
join.
So, here's the invitation. I would invite people to look into their own hearts and ponder it out in their own minds. Really kind of do this pattern that we've been taught for finding knowledge and decide, is this important to you? Do you want to know about the nature, power, and duties of our Mother in Heaven, about God, our Mother? And if you find that that is an important thing to you, then on the third Sunday of every month, please join with us in fasting in whatever way that you fast, whether it's a full 24 hours or two meals or fasting from something else because you can't abstain from food for whatever reason. Fast in whatever way is a devotion and a sacrifice to you on the third Sunday of every month, and dedicate that day to praying personally and collectively for further light and knowledge regarding the nature, duties, and power of Mother in Heaven, of knowing more about who she is, what she does. Her name would be awesome. And for inspiration, not only for ourselves, so that we can have this testimony for ourselves and prepare our own hearts, but also inspiration for our leaders, for the general authorities, for the first presidency, for the prophet, that if they are not already asking, which they may be, but if they're not, that they will ask themselves. And that sometime in the near future would be nice, that they will come out with something official, be it something like the Proclamation on the Family, the Living Christ, or Doctrine and Covenants Section 138, which was the recounting of a vision of Joseph F. Smith regarding the Celestial Kingdom, that he talked about it, or the series of visions, he talked about it in General Conference. And I think that something like that, having that sort of an experience, particularly on the topic of Mother in Heaven, would really strengthen us as a people, as a faith. And I think it would bolster our faith in the idea that our leaders are divinely guided. So if you, dear listeners, are interested, please join us and help us prove as a people to the Lord and to the Lady that we're ready for this, if indeed we are. And I mean, the worst we can get in response is no, not yet. That's the worst answer we can get.
And it sounds like you're not expecting the worst. Sounds like you have a heart filled with hope that something wonderful is going to come.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it may not be this conference. It would be awesome if it was. But like I said, there's 14 million people just in the church. It would be awesome if a few hundred of us getting together, or a few thousand, or however many people are listening, it would be awesome if a small number of us could make that change. But I feel like it's going to be a process because there's still a lot of people that need to be prepared. So to join in that process and to get it moving in a conscious direction and saying, yes, we're ready. We're awakened to this idea and we want to move forward.
Well, I think this sounds like a wonderful idea and I hope that many join in.
I do too.
And for those that are listening, there are resources that will be posted along with this podcast, including a link to Jenna's blog post about this fasting project. Thanks for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. I invite you to respond at daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com. If you have ideas for future episodes, I'd love to hear about them. Thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the music.